Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Remakers Mark. This is Andy Wicks hosting our annual In Memoriam episode where we're going to talk about some of the celebrities and actors that we lost in the last year. With me tonight is Kyle Delahunt. Kyle, how are you?
I am well. Thank you. Sorry. There was like a little trailing ellipses there.
There was waiting. There was, but as okay. If there was going to be a second question, but there is not.
But no. Hey, very good. Well, I don't ever want to jump on a hanging ellipses too much. So I just want to give it a pause, give it the time. I'm doing very well.
If that's not your family crest, I don't know what is, but please put that over your mantle. I never want to jump on a hanging ellipses. And also Lee, pour one out for the homies. Lee, how are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Glad to hear that. Jer and Mark are not able to be with us live, but we're going to hear from them virtually as we go along. This time, we're going to have two picks. The first one's going to be a bit of a longer one, where we're going to eulogize some of the folks that we lost that were dear and near to us. Not near and dear, but dear and near. And then we're going to do a quick little lightning round for some of those who we just didn't have the time to talk about at length. I'll start us out, since I'm hosting, and I'm just not going to stop.
Keep going.
I'm going to talk about Albert Finney. Albert Finney was born in 1936, passed away on February 7th, 2019. He's a British actor of stage and screen with a career that stretched into 7 decades.
Woo.
I know. Depending on your age, you would know him for various different roles. He was a graduate of the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts and a member of the Royal Shakespeare Company, and was actually active in the stage intermittently throughout his career. He had these periods of time when he would alternate between making feature films and or television and then jumping into the stage for at times years at a time before returning to the screen. He made his screen debut in 1960 in The Entertainer and then made a name for himself in another film of the same year entitled Saturday Night and Sunday Morning. But he earned his first of five Academy Award nominations for Best Actor in 1963's Tom Jones, in which he played the titular character. His film career includes, and this is pretty cool, as I was doing some research, I knew Albert Finney from what I thought were several roles, but I had no idea exactly how long this guy's acting resume was. So here's a small smattering. 1967's Two for the Road, which he co-starred with Audrey Hepburn. 1970s Scrooge, in which he played Scrooge, along with Alec Guinness as the ghost of Joseph Marley.
Ooh.
I know. 1974's Murder on the Orient Express, in which he played Hercule Poirot. Did you guys know that?
I did not.
I did not either. Nope. I had assumed, obviously erroneously, that it was only played by David Suchet, I believe is the actor, who was in probably the PBS show that most of us, if we are familiar with any Poirot, it's probably that show.
And recently, Kenneth Branagh.
But yeah, there's a long list of very qualified actors who have played Hercule Poirot, including Albert Finney, Orson Welles, Kenneth Branagh. I should have written it down. It's like 10 or 12 really good actors. So
yeah.
Anyhow, I move on. Annie, 1982, Daddy Warbucks. That's where I first knew who he was. The Dresser in 1983, earning a Best Actor nomination. Under the Volcano in 1984, another Best Actor nomination. Miller's Crossing, 1990s, Coen Brothers. Did you know that?
Oh, I kind of forgot about that.
He played one of the gang bosses, I believe.
Yeah.
2000's Aaron Brockovich as Aaron Brockovich's lawyer boss, I should say. A small role in Traffic in 2000. A large role in 2001's Big Fish.
I remember that.
Yep. With Ewan McGregor and Billy Crudup.
I don't remember. I just remember Ewan.
And then directed by Tim Burton in that one.
Yeah.
And then The Bourne Ultimatum in 2007. And then his last performance as James Bond's groundskeeper in Skyfall in 2012.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's right. I forgot that was him.
Yep. He was nominated for 5 Academy Awards, attended none of the Oscars ceremonies, considering them a waste of time, which I think is awesome.
That's fantastic.
There's another story that we heard at one time. I was trying to track it down. I was not able to find it, but it was the story went something along the lines of he was sailing around the world, kind of on a vacation, was nominated for a Best Actor Academy Award, and ended up losing, I think, to Sidney Poitier, which was kind of a landmark at the time because Sidney Poitier was the first African-American man to win Best Actor. And a reporter found out where Albert Finney was. He was essentially on a boat, like dancing with these bikini clad ladies. And he came out to the boat in like a canoe and asked him like for his take on the fact that he did not win. You know, and he lost to Sidney Poitier, kind of Sidney Poitier looking for the, like the scandalous thing. And this Albert Finney apparently stopped dancing long enough to essentially say like, good on him. He deserved the award. It was great. Let's get back to dancing. And that was it.
So that's fantastic.
So Albert Finney, my first encounter with him was Annie. I think it was probably for a lot of people our age.
Probably me too.
But I mean, again, depending on your age, it was probably you either knew him as a Shakespearean actor, you knew him as Tom Jones, you knew him as Ebenezer Scrooge, you knew him as a lot of different things. So that's my longer eulogy tonight. Albert Finney, you were a giant of a man. Well, maybe not. I think you're probably average sized, but he had a very large personality, and I loved watching you act.
His jowls were that of a much larger man.
Ooh, man.
He was well jowled.
He did talk sometimes as if he had like 60 teeth.
Yeah.
You know,
it's true.
But he made it work.
The Brando school.
He made it work. So,
yeah. There's a certain caliber of actor, and most of them are British. The one that comes to mind is Richard Harris. But like, there's some people that would just come on to like The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson or something like that. And it was always the best because Johnny would just be like, so Albert or so Richard, what have you been up to? And then they just talk for like 20 minutes because they can. And it's just like they live fascinating lives and they're just like such amazing storytellers. Like that's a dying breed for sure. We don't really have many of those anymore, but I think of him when I think of that type of person.
Yeah, I can imagine Johnny Carson just sitting back and saying, tell me a story.
Uh-huh, exactly.
And then the audience just hanging on his every word.
Mm-hmm.
Next up, we have Jer talking about someone who is near and dear to all of us here as the faithful original portrayer of Chewbacca, Mr. Peter Mayhew.
Hey, everyone. Jeremy here. I am going to be speaking firstly about Peter Mayhew. You would know Peter exclusively or nearly exclusively from the role of Chewbacca from the Star Wars movies. He was the human behind Chewbacca from the original Star Wars in 1977 all the way up through The Force Awakens in 2015, at which point his knees and back were getting to a point where it was difficult for him to stand for any length of time, and he was forced to retire from the role and from acting. As I have said on this podcast before, Star Wars is or was the first movie that I had ever seen. First movie I saw in the theater and first movie that I had ever seen as a kid, and it is very near and dear to my heart, and Chewbacca will forever be my favorite character in the Star Wars universe. And I attribute a lot of that to how Peter Mayhew portrayed him. Peter as a human being was a very gentle person. He kind of epitomized that adage of the gentle giant. And he has since or throughout his career also written a couple of children's books, one of which sort of talked about the fact that he was very tall and how differences are strengths, not weaknesses, and then another book as well. He stands at 7'3" tall, or did at his peak, no pun intended, and he embraced that as he could, and used that in both his role as Chewbacca and in other ways to teach and to really bring about this idea that being different is okay, and being different is something that you should embrace and not feel ashamed about. And getting back to his role in Star Wars, he really built Chewbacca as a very lovable, gentle character. And, I think that was more so his doing than it was Lucas's doing. I don't think that George Lucas envisioned Chewbacca to be what he was or what he ended up being. And I think that a lot of that goes to how Peter portrayed him. And as I have watched the most recent trilogy and looked at how the new actor has portrayed Chewbacca in both The Last Jedi and Rise of Skywalker, Junis Suotama is his name. As I have looked at as I watch those movies, which I enjoy those movies, but there is something different about Chewbacca in those movies, and it made me really realize how much of Peter Mayhew is in Chewbacca, in the performance and in the character, and it speaks so highly of him as an actor and as a person that he was able to convey so much of his own spirit into this role that was basically wearing a big giant bear costume. And you never saw his face. You could see his eyes. It was all in how he moved and how he reacted and expressed himself through gestures and not even noises, because that was all piped in later as well. So it really is extraordinary to me that I can watch several different Star Wars movies and know when I'm watching Peter Mayhew and when I'm not. And that is not just from the timeline, but also from just being able to watch the performance and really feel how much of Chewbacca is in Peter and how much of Peter is in Chewbacca. And it just makes me love the character even more. And for all outward appearances and every interview that you saw him in, Peter himself was just an upstanding and amazing person. He would often, as Chewbacca, go visit children in hospitals. He made appearances all over the place. He embraced that role. He loved it. As I said, he wrote two children's books, one called Growing Up Giant and one called My Favorite Giant, which is an anti-bullying book. He was just an amazing person, and it was sad to see him struggle to want to continue with the Chewbacca role and being unable to. And in the latter years, he had knee replacement in 2013, which allowed him some additional mobility. But in 2015, he was hospitalized with pneumonia, and that kind of signified the end of his acting career, as he said that his mobility was just going down and down. And so he and his replacement basically tag teamed the role of Chewbacca in The Force Awakens, and then he gave it up after that. And then in April 30th of 2019, he passed away just before his 75th birthday from a heart attack. And he will be missed. His presence, if they make a dozen more Star Wars movies, which I hope they don't, but if they do, and if they're at all related to Chewbacca and they have someone playing Chewbacca, it won't be the same. He will be missed, both in the Star Wars community and just on this planet. That is Peter Mayhew.
Next up, we're going to hear from Lee. Pour one out for the homies, talking about not an actor, but certainly an influential performer and creator of the arts. Lee, go ahead.
Thank you. I'm talking about Rick Ocasek. Most people would know him as one of the founding members of the band The Cars, which was very big in the 70s and 80s. He was born in 1944, and he passed away September 15th of this year, or last year, sorry, 2019. I believe I was in Vienna when I heard he died. He, like many musicians, went through a series of bands before he landed with the band that would propel him to much success and kind of, in a lot of ways, define his career. I think my earliest memories of him were listening to The Cars when my sister would play that on her stereo when I was a kid. She was older. She was very much into music, and whatever she listened to, I listened to. So, you know, from ages 3 to maybe 10, I listened to a lot of, like, Van Halen, Def Leppard, The Cars, Kiss, that sort of stuff. And it always stuck with me. And it's something with The Cars that I kind of revisited when I was a teenager, because there was a certain nostalgia that it held for me. And I always enjoyed their music. It's one of those bands that, you know, when you hear one of their songs, even if you're not familiar with a song, you know it's them, because they just have such a distinct sound. And I think a lot of that has to do with his writing. And then later on in his career, he moved on to producing. And I remember in 1994, first time listening to Weezer's Blue album. You know, it's one of those albums that I loved immediately, and I could listen to the whole thing and enjoy the whole thing. And I remember thinking, wow, this is really like the 90s version of the Cars. It's got the same,
yeah,
it's got the same kind of vibe and everything, and the same type of writing and song structure and all that stuff. And when I was looking at my CD case and looking at who the producer was, it was Rick Ocasek.
I'm like, oh, no way. Okay. I never knew that.
Yeah. I was like, oh, okay, well, that makes sense then.
he did, I think, three or four of their records, I want to say. He's done three quite of them. A few of, yeah.
Yeah, three of them. But yeah, he also he has producing credits for Hole, No Doubt, Bad Religion, and of course, yeah, three Weezer albums, their Blue album, their Green album, and then the one, I think it's titled Everything Will Be All Right in the End.
Which, that's a good record.
Yeah. And Motion City soundtrack. So, I mean,
he produced a Motion City soundtrack record, really?
He has credits on their third album.
No way. That's crazy. Cool.
So, he's a really versatile guy, and music was very much a part of who he was. I mean, I think very much defined who he was and that he loved it. I don't know if he had any formal training or if he was just one of those virtuosos that went by sound. I think the music world is a little darker without him. I'm kind of bummed that I'm not going to hear any more music that's produced by him. But I'm thankful that we have, the music that he wrote, recorded, and produced now. So
yeah,
in that way, you know, it'll always be here. He'll always be here in that way, I guess.
Yeah.
He was, his music, both as, well, now, and especially hearing all the production credits that he had, but especially as a musician, he was everywhere. Like listening to the Cars, listen, you know, like scrolling through their catalog, be like, oh, I know that song. I know that song. I know that song. I know that song. I know that song.
Yeah.
You know, they had so many hits on the radio that while they weren't necessarily number one hits, but they were certainly catchy. I mean, any Cars song is just all about the hook. Mm-hmm. And they're simple, but they're effective, and they're so good. So, so good.
Yeah, it's pretty immediately recognizable, too. Like, he had a pretty distinctive voice, and the use of guitars and synthesizers, I thought, was pretty unique. You know, it was sort of a smush of new wave and punk to create this kind of new form, which was power pop, which has always been one of my favorite genres. So I don't know if they're truly like one of the inventors of it. It sure feels that way. I haven't dug quite that deep on it, but it definitely feels that way to me. Or if so, maybe they kind of were the fine tip point at the end of the refinement of power pop. And it was pretty much how I would define power pop as car songs.
They, you know, and yeah, we're getting into a little bit of music nerdery here, but I think it would be probably safe to say that if they weren't the originators of it, they were probably the first big public hit of that genre. Yep. You know, exposing it to a wider, much wider audience.
Agreed. I also love that he was just kind of a dork. Like, he's kind of he's like the Roy Orbison school of popular, where you're like, how did this guy get popular? Like,
he was a weird looking dude.
He's not handsome. Like, he looked like, it's like Mick Mars and Motley Crue looks like 30 years older than all the other bandies. And I think he is like legitimately older than all of them. But like, I don't know, man. Rick Ocasek looked like he was like 50 when he was 20 or 25. I don't know. He just kind of always looked that way. But I was like, man.
Was he married to a model for a time?
Yeah. For,
I can't remember who.
Paulina
Porsakova?
Yeah. Wasn't it her?
I don't know.
He's kind of in the Lyle Lovett, Julia Roberts kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
She loved him for his personality.
Yep.
There was a great joke that David Spade had on Saturday Night Live when he used to do the Hollywood Minute. I don't know if you ever saw any of those.
Yeah, I remember that.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them, it was just a picture of Rick Ocasek. And David Spade just goes, "Hey, Rick, why the long face?"
That's perfect. Oh, man. That's so good.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
All right.
Nice. Woo. Good job, Lee.
I nicely like that done. One. Nicely
good
done.
Good choice. Yep.
Kyle, you have a eulogy that I'm worried might make the room a little dusty.
I kind of excel at those.
I mean, you do.
I'm a room dusty maker.
But this one definitely needs to be said. I'm really excited to hear it. Please take it away.
Thank you. So I'm going to be talking about Carol Spinney. Most people will know Carol Spinney as the creator and Muppeteer. Is that the right phrase? Yeah, we'll say it. The Muppeteer.
Is it a Muppet or a puppet?
Know. Well, it's a puppet, but they are Muppets too.
Was Bigfoot a Muppet? Yeah, I guess he was.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was controlled that way. So we'll say Muppeteer of Big Bird and Oscar the Grouch on Sesame Street. So before we get into exactly those roles, I want to talk a little bit about sort of from whence he came. He was born on December 26th, 1933 in Massachusetts. He was named Carol because he was born the day after Christmas, which I think is kind of cool. That's kind of clever. I like that. He was very artistic as a child, and he started this fascination with puppetry at the age of 5 upon seeing a puppet show on television. While in the Air Force, he was, you know, all kinds of different artistic. He created a comic strip about military life called Harvey, and then he had an animated series called Crazy Crayon. So, you know, just sort of honing his artistic talent and skills. In his 20s and early 30s, he bounced between Las Vegas and then Massachusetts, his home state, performing and puppeteering in lots of different types of live and then eventually TV shows. Some are Google and Judy, Bozo's Big Top, and Wow, You're a Cartoonist. That's the actual name of that. I was just thinking back of like, man, what a day TV was when you could have shows called Google and Judy, Bozo's Big Top, and Wow, You're a Cartoonist. I certainly think that if someone, you know, moved forward in time and watched TV shows now, I'm sure they would be scandalized in many different ways. But man, that's some crazy stuff. Like that's good TV right there. So the fateful relationship that changed his life and many, many millions of kids and adults' lives first started in 1962, where he met Jim Henson at the backstage at a show that he was performing. They didn't actually end up basically like hooking up and meeting from an official standpoint until 1969. And he convinced him, Jim Henson convinced Carol to join the inaugural season of Sesame Street. And there he was from the get-go, the roles of Big Bird and Oscar the Grouch. I'll talk about Oscar first because I want to talk more about Big Bird overall. But Oscar was essentially what's on the label, right? He pretty much described his name. He was grouchy. He lived in a trash can, but somehow managed to find goodness and understanding in those around him in spite of himself and said grouchiness. It's a pretty interesting character, you know, especially in contrast. It's a hell of a contrast between Oscar the Grouch and Big Bird. You know, Oscar the Grouch is world-weary and crabby, and Big Bird is the opposite of that. So Big Bird started his existence in Sesame Street as this weird, nasally voiced, kind of like yuckster character, and then eventually transitioned into what Jesse Thorne of the wonderful podcast Bullseye referred to in a great interview that he did with Spinney. He referred to him as a child looking out into the world.
Big Bird,
that's just the perfect description for me, and that's really what made him stick out for so many kids and then now into adults. He was a lovable character because how he looked and moved, but most of all because he was the de facto stand-in for children. His voice was high, but not ridiculously so, and the things he talked about and the questions he asked were those which a child might be thinking, feeling, or worrying about as they watched the show. Sesame Street was never one to shy away from having hard conversations, and they acknowledged that children were able to absorb and digest hard things, especially with the help of someone they knew and loved, like Big Bird. A perfect example of this was after the actor who played Mr. Hooper passed away.
Mm.
Big Bird was the character that didn't know what that meant and received guidance from all the adults on the show, and in doing so broke down much of the fear and worry around such a topic that exists in the world, but is incredibly hard to explain to kids. We'll link to that clip in the show notes here. It really is extraordinary. I watched it earlier today, and I probably watched it I don't know, half a dozen times in my life. There's a group of the adults of the show just kind of hanging out in and among Sesame Street. And Big Bird comes by and says, oh, I have gifts for all of you. And they said, oh, wow, what's that? And he had drawn pictures for all of them. So he hands them out one by one. And he finally says, and last but not least, Mr. Hooper. Oh, where is Mr. Hooper? And then they say, oh, remember Big Bird we talked about? He died. He said, oh, it's okay. I'll give it to him when he comes back. And then they say, well, no, Big Bird. He's not coming back. When someone dies, they don't come back. And it's just really extraordinary writing. And to give that responsibility to an 8-foot, 2-inch bird puppet that was basically the face of children, or the voice of children, or sort of the presentation of children, was really extraordinary. And he was not only the voice for it, but he was also inside that suit. We'll put a link in the show notes as far as what he actually had to do.
It's in crazy. That suit.
It's crazy. Crazy. It really is. Yeah. It's when you think about doing that day in, day out for 50 years, that is nuts.
Like, how did he not have shoulder problems?
I know, exactly. Yeah, it's really extraordinary. And you realize how much emotion comes through in that performance of just a guy in a big-ass bird suit. Like, it's amazing.
I was looking through his Wikipedia page as you were just talking, and they were talking about, and I had forgotten about this character entirely until I read about it. He also did Bruno the Trash Man.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the character that carried around Oscar's trash can.
Yep.
And Carol Spinney was obviously inside that suit, but I had totally forgotten about that character. Yeah. And essentially they had to stop using it because the costume broke down. Like, it just started breaking, and I was like, oh,
yeah.
But I remembered that character now as soon as I read that.
Yep. They also used one of the old Big Bird costumes and sort of repurposed it slightly for Big Bird's either mom or grandma, that showed up from time to time. Yep. Grandmother, yeah. It's all about those public broadcasting budgets. Do what you can with exactly. What you got.
Reduce, reuse, yes. Recycle.
Exactly. So Carol performed as Big Bird and Oscar the Grouch until 2019, 50 years after originating the roles. He wrote books about his experience and was the subject of a documentary about his life and being Big Bird called I Am Big Bird, The Carol Spinney Story. He is someone that the more I think about it, the gladder, all of the above, I am that he was in the world. Like, it's just an amazing thing, and what a gift he gave to children to have a show that treated them as just humans, not kids, not troublemakers, but just people that could take interesting, challenging things and process them with their help. And there's just so many millions of people that have been affected by that, including myself and probably all of us here. So I'm just so glad that he was in the world and lived to the ripe age of 86. So Carol Spinney, thank you for doing what you did. And after this, I'm probably going to go watch the Jim Henson Memorial and bawl my eyes out, because that's what you got to do sometimes. It's just what you do.
Need a good cry.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, indeed.
All right. Thank you, Kyle.
You're welcome.
All right. Now the lightning round. Well, we're not going to talk about people who died by electrocution or lightning strike. Just
wait, what? We're not?
You can. Oh, you can. Okay. It's just not a requirement.
Okay. Okay, cool.
Okay. Kyle, you're actually up first, and you're talking about one of my favorite comedians, so I'm excited to hear what you have to say. Please, take it away.
Yeah, so talking about lightning, I was going to be talking about old Lightning Rod Jones. He grew up in Missouri. He unfortunately had a steel plate in his skull and doggone it, got killed by a lightning strike. Just kidding.
That was
I'm going to be talking about Tim Conway this fine evening. Tim Conway was almost the identical age of Carol Spinney, my first pick. And this will be much lighter in tone. So, you know, hopefully you'll be fine with that. He was born on December 15th rather than December 26th. And he was born in Willoughby, Ohio, a suburb of Cleveland. He served in the armed forces after graduating from Bowling Green from the years of 1956 to 1958, where he majored in television. So that's cool. That was a legit major back then. Speaking of weird things, he started his television career as a news broadcaster. And man, oh man, do I want to get a hold of some of those news broadcasts, because that sounds like just a recipe for greatness. He managed to work in a lot of comedy and silliness in that role. And what he was known for later, which was making his co-stars break like crazy was very much the case then. The silliness that he portrayed in there paid off as it resulted in several comedic roles in television shows of the time, including The Steve Allen Show, McHale's Navy, Turn On, which is ABC's blatant laugh-in ripoff, two different versions of his own The Tim Conway Show, but most of all as a member of the brilliant ensemble cast of The Carol Burnett Show.
Oh.
Here, his particular brand of comedy, which mixed a willingness to go anywhere a character might go to elicit a joke with a panache for improvisation that left his fellow cast members breaking scenes constantly with laughter, made him a favorite of audience and co-stars alike. There are some amazing, amazing clips out there. I know, Andy, you sent us the dentist clip, I remember, a few months ago, after right when he passed away. And my God, is that funny. So we'll link to that in the show notes. But
talk about making his coworkers break character. He made Harvey Korman wet his pants on stage.
Yeah. Yeah. Unreal. So incredibly funny. I'm not ashamed. Okay, maybe I'm gently ashamed, but I was first introduced to Tim Conway's brand of humor by his dwarf character, which now, of course, seems like a silly and slightly offensive and sexist send-up of little people. But boy, howdy, did it tickle my kid funny bone. I watched a couple dwarf on golf clips today, and God, I still laughed hard. It's in spite of how terrible it is, man, is it funny. His caddy was Vincent Chiavelli, who in the movie Ghost, he's like the ghost on the subway that won't leave him alone. Yep. That guy, like, speaking of, like, you know, why the long face? Boy, he and Rick Ocasek could have a long face off. Anyways, that just struck me as really funny. But man, it's just so ridiculous, but really, really funny. Unfortunately, Conway ended up with normal pressure hydrocephalus, which is a kind of an ongoing growing pressure in the brain, resulting in dementia in 2018. And then he passed away on May 14th, 2019. But man, he left a body of comedic work that is extraordinary and influences many, many comedians and actors to this day. So, Tim, thank you for your work and your comedy. And man, after watching the Jim Henson Memorial, I'll chase that with some Tim Conway comedy, and I'll be right as rain.
Nicely done. Oh, man. I'm going to talk about Bruno Ganz. I think Ganz is how you pronounce it.
I think it's probably right.
Ganz. Bruno Ganz was a Swiss actor, but he's mostly known, well, he probably is known, if you know him at all, for his work in German film and television, then a career that lasted almost 60 years. Now, I'm not going to lie. I haven't seen much of Bruno Ganz and much of his work. But I have seen Downfall, and that's enough to know that yes. Bruno Ganz was one hell of an actor. If you haven't seen Downfall, I recommend it highly. In it, he portrays Adolf Hitler in the last final days of as opposed to the first final days. Good one, Andy. In the final days of Adolf Hitler's life, all essentially told from inside the bunker in Berlin. And it's fantastic. Absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
Of all the portrayals that I've seen of Hitler, and there's been countless, his is my favorite. It's also the source of countless memes, which are also quite funny. If you ever want to look those up, just search Bruno Ganz Adolf Hitler meme. You're going to find them. They're pretty funny.
Yeah.
But a little interesting tidbit, and I was sharing this with Kyle and Lee before we started, that apparently in German-speaking countries, they have some pretty impressive titles that they pass along to each other. So I'm going to read a quote from Wikipedia, from the entry for Bruno Ganz. Quote, from 1996 until his death in 2019, Ganz held the Republic of Austria's Iflandring, and I apologize for my mispronunciation, which passes from actor to actor, each bequeathing the ring to the next holder, judging that actor to be, quote, the most significant and worthy actor of the German-speaking theater, end quote. Continuing on the quote, however, because that was a quote within a quote, here we go. Ganz was also honored with the Order of Merit in Germany and was made a knight of the French Legion d'Honneur, the Legion of Honor. End all the quotes. So the Iflandring goes back, I was looking it up, to the early 19th century. So, dang.
Dang.
Dang, dang, dang. So Bruno Ganz, hell of an actor, Swiss, but in German and all that.
You should definitely check out Wings of Desire, the Wim Wenders.
He was
really excellent in that.
Yeah, he worked with some pretty amazing directors, including Wim Wenders, like you said, Werner Herzog, Francis Ford Coppola, et cetera, et cetera.
Yep.
So, all right. Let's move on to Jer, who's going to talk about Peter Tork.
And my second pick, or the second person that I'm going to be speaking about, and also the second Peter that I'm going to be speaking about, is Peter Tork, who you would know as one quarter of the musical comedy TV show group thing, The Monkees, which was a TV show and also a music group that happened back in the 60s. It was basically a lampoon and a spoof of the Beatles and Beatlemania that was an idea hatched in weirdo Hollywood that they wanted to make a fake Beatles-esque band that was all American musicians, and they wanted it to be sort of tongue-in-cheek and build a comedy TV show around it. And Peter Tork was the keyboardist and bass player for that group, and also a hilarious performer on the show. His full name is Peter Halston Thorkelson, which is great. I mainly chose this pick because of my mom, who loves the Monkees, and we would watch the TV show all the time. I loved their music, and it was kind of a toss-up as I watched it, who my favorite was between Peter and Mickey. Mickey being sort of the favorite of everybody because he was the biggest goofball, but Peter was sort of this silent. He was excellent at being kind of the setup man and the dopey one. He was always sort of in the joke but not creating the joke, and I love when performers are able to do that. And he was a bass player, and I also love that. Being a bass player myself, I actually, because of him, started wearing my belts sideways because I saw that he was doing that on the show, and learned later that that was because of the belt buckle scratching up the back of the guitar. So you would wear the belt buckle way over on your hip. And I actually started doing that because of him, and which didn't do any good because the back of my bass guitar is already so chewed up from belts and whatnot. So a little too late, but it's a little bit of an influence from good old Peter Tork. And he was a very accomplished musician, and as you can see from the Monkees' music, it is not comedy music. It is very good for the style and the time. Some of their songs are still around today. And then his performance on that show was so odd and so great, and I just loved it. And so as a little tribute to my mom and the what little remains of the original cast of the Monkees, I am just saluting Peter Tork. Here's to you, and thanks for being the weirdest musical influence that I have probably had.
All right, Jer, thank you for that wonderful summary of a monkey. The monkey? He was the main monkey.
He was a monkey.
Was he a monkey's uncle?
He was the hard to say. He was the guitar player monkey.
All right. That's a funny sentence.
It is.
And not one I ever thought I would say.
But here we are.
And yet here we are, Lee. And now it's your turn to tell us about Robert Forster. Take it away.
Well, Robert Forster was born in 1941. Interesting that both of my picks tonight were born during World War II. He's an American actor who people would probably know best from the movie Jackie Brown, which was Quentin Tarantino's third movie.
I love that movie.
Yeah, that's the first movie I ever saw him in. But his list of credits are quite long before that. He did a lot of work in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, a lot of TV spots, smaller movies, that sort of thing. And I think the movie Jackie Brown kind of revived his career a bit and got him bigger parts, because after that, I saw him in Mulholland Drive, Me, Myself, and Irene. And I think the last thing I ever saw him in was an episode of Breaking Bad. where he plays somebody who's paid to help people hide. So he helps Walter White sort of disappear because he's wanted by lots of law enforcement agencies. But, you know, he's got that great style. Like, he's one of those actors who doesn't really disappear into a character. He just sort of plays himself. He's got, you know, that great Chicago accent that my friends and I would imitate a lot when, you know, after we saw Jackie Brown, because we just thought it was charming and hilarious. But yeah, he had such a great style of acting, and he was sort of like the, whatever story he was in, he brought a lot of warmth to whatever that character was. I don't know if you've ever seen Me, Myself, and Irene, but he plays a state trooper colonel, and he's like Jim Carrey's boss or whatever. And I was watching that, and I was listening to the director commentary, and they were talking about Robert Forrester and saying, you know, he was really his character, and he was really the heart and soul of the shoot, because he was like so gracious and giving, and just a nice guy to be around, fun to work with, and really funny. And I think he brought that kind of thing to all of his performances, even, you know, in a show like Breaking Bad, where he's playing a bad guy, essentially like doing a lot of illegal things. He still did it with a lot of warmth. And that's what I think he brought to, you know, cinema and television. So he passed away on October 11th. Looks like from brain cancer. I didn't realize that he had gotten sick, but it looks like he was 78. And yeah, it's too bad, because I think there would have been a lot more roles out there for him, because he was such a great actor, very quiet, not flashy at all, but everything that he was in, he was really good in. So
it's a good description of him, because he was not flashy, but he was very solid in what he did.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. It reminds me of like a Harry Dean Stanton, where like, yep, he could have gotten a second pivot, you know, like he could have then kind of become like an older character actor, of which, mm-hmm, there are plenty of opportunities and not a lot of people that can do a lot of diversity in that. You know, mm-hmm, you have the Pacino De Niro's of the world, where they're like, they're doing Pacino and De Niro, you know, but it's like, you know, Harry Dean Stanton and Robert Forrester can kind of take whatever you throw at them. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I love this little tidbit on his Wikipedia page that his father, Robert Forrester Sr., was an elephant trainer for the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus.
Yeah, dang, I saw that.
That's pretty cool.
Too bad he didn't go into the family business. Yeah. Maybe he did. I don't know.
Maybe he did. Maybe this is all just a long con.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Lee. And that wraps up this annual edition of In Memoriam, our short, small, but heartfelt tribute to some of the performers and creators that we lost in the last year. Thank you for sticking along with us, and hope you enjoyed it as well. Remakers Mark is a proud member of the Math is Hard Network. To find out more information about this podcast or any other podcast on the network, check us out, mathishard.net. There you will find show notes with links to all the people, movies, and links discussed in this episode. This information is also attached to the show file in the podcast client of your choice. You can find us anywhere you listen to podcasts, including Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, etc., etc., where you can rate and review Remakers Mark, which would mean the world to us. We are on both Facebook and Twitter at Remakers Mark, and Instagram at Remakers Mark Podcast, so please join in the discussion there too. Kyle, Lee, thank you for joining me tonight. Jaren, Mark, we'll see you later, I guess. All right, gentlemen, may the force be with you.
And also with you.